everyone. Welcome back to I See What You're Saying, the Disciplined Listening Podcast. I'm Michael Reddington, and today it is my pleasure to welcome our next guest, Peter Warmka. Peter is a retired senior intelligence officer with the CIA, where he specialized in clandestine human intelligence collection. He is also a certified fraud examiner and a certified protection professional. He's the author of two books, Confessions of a CIA Spy and Why Are You Messing With Me? He currently serves as a speaker and consultant, and he travels working with organizations and individuals to teach them how to stay safe from human hacking and insider threats. And I'm really excited to share this conversation with you as he dives into his experience, his background, his stories, and teaches us how we can apply these lessons in our businesses and our daily lives, not only to protect ourselves, but to protect the people we care about as well. So he's going to start by diving into helping us understand what really constitutes human hacking, social engineering. How does it happen? How do we leave ourselves open to it? And how can we recognize it? He's going to dive into different influence factors. He's going to talk about the difference between manipulation and incentivization. And he's going to share how he learned to apply the art of elicitation among many, many more ideas and techniques. So, Peter, thank you so much for sharing everything with us. I really appreciate it. Of course, thank you to all of you for continuing to take the time and join us week after week. We appreciate you listening and watching these conversations. Before we dive in, we want to take a moment to thank our sponsors. So please, before you leave today, check out the show notes and visit humantel.com to learn more about identifying shifts in emotion through facial expressions and nonverbal behavior, how you can apply that in your world. You can check out the International Association of Interviewers to answer all your questions, not only about the association, but about the Certified Forensic Interviewer designation as well. And of course, you can check out inquasive.com for the customized training programs our clients ask us to teach their senior leaders, sales teams, and human resources teams. We really appreciate you being here week after week. Thank you so much. So let's get right to it. Without further ado, I introduce to you Peter Warmka. Hello, Peter. It is so great to see you. Thank you very much for taking the time to be here today. How are you?
Hey, Michael. Good morning. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you so much for the invitation to be on the podcast. I followed you for a while, and I liked a lot of the topics that have been discussed in the podcast, and I'm really I'm very, very pleased and enthusiastic to be able to share whatever I can share.
Well, I appreciate that. Thank you very much. I certainly appreciate you checking us out and grateful to have the opportunity to pick your brain a little bit today and hopefully help us all understand how we can communicate better, interact with people better, but also understand when maybe people are trying to mislead us or take advantage of us as well. So I'd love to start there if you don't mind. I think we all hear, maybe not we all, but many of us have probably heard the terms human hacking and social engineering. And I know as technology evolves, those techniques change and evolve as well. But I'd be grateful if we could start by asking you to please explain to us, what does human hacking and social engineering really mean?
Yeah, I'm glad you brought both those terms in because they're really one and the same. I like using human hacking more than social engineering because it's more visual, right? Think about hacking into someone's mind. Instead of hacking into the computer, you're actually hacking into somebody's mind, being able to understand them, being able to know what their vulnerabilities, their motivations might be. The end result is to manipulate them. Manipulate them to undertake some action that may or may not be in their interest, but is definitely in the interest of the social engineer. You know, that is an objective that the social engineer wants to accomplish by manipulating the person that they're dealing with, whether, and it can be by many different types of communication channels, right? Anyway, we can reach out and touch someone as a social engineer. Well, of course, that can be, you know, we hear a lot about phishing. It can be phishing. It can be via text messages, which are smishing. It can be via telephone calls with vishing, or it can be that face-to-face interaction, you know, or even social media also is becoming more and more popular. So those are the channels of communication that can all be utilized by a social engineer or human hacker in an attempt to manipulate someone.
So I think I have seven questions that I'd already like to ask. That might be an exaggeration. It might be five, but we'll see if I can remember them as we go through. The first one I'd love to ask is just your feeling about the word manipulation. a lot of times I feel like when I interact with people, whether I'm teaching or speaking or having conversations, that word manipulation comes up a lot. Do you believe, well, actually, I don't want to lead you in one direction or the other. What do you believe the word manipulation really means when it comes to interpersonal communication?
Well, I mean, you're trying to, when you're manipulating somebody, you're not really, you know, they're doing something that they probably would not normally do. Okay. Normally do. Because if they're going to do it, you know, regardless of what you say or do, or, you know, then it's kind of like, it's not really manipulating them. They've already made the decision and they're going to do this. Right. But you can manipulate them in such a way that they undertake an action and do it quicker. Right. And maybe waiting and putting it off. Or they ended up taking an action without looking at the options that they might have for not taking that action immediately. I mean, think about this is one clear example I think everybody can identify with. There's a number of influence factors in human hacking, and one of them is scarcity. Okay. You probably all your listeners have are familiar with Expedia, right? If you do a search on Expedia, want to take a flight to a location, or you want to rent, you know, book a hotel. When you put in the search category, whatever you want, and you see the results, especially with flights, every single result is going to show only two left or only four left at this price, right? So that's influence, you know, scarcity, lack of these opportunities. If I don't take advantage of this now, I will lose out, right? So it doesn't, you know, people are manipulated to undertake, you know, click that on right now. Instead of saying, well, I'm going to come back to this. Let me compare a few other locations where I might be able to purchase, you know, other options before coming back and doing this one. If I find something better, I'm not going to do this one, right? So that's manipulating somebody and making a decision immediately. That they're going to make a decision for something, but it's really manipulating them to take that action much quicker than what they would normally would do, right? So that's one of many different examples of manipulation. And of course, there's that manipulation to have somebody undertake an action that they would normally not do at all, right? It's manipulating them to, and we see a lot of times that with different scammers, right? They will, you know, so many different approaches. That it even happens a lot with our elderly population where they will use the phone to call people and impersonation, saying that's from the IRS, right? And so the impersonate being from the IRS, and the influence technique they're going to use is fear, right? You haven't paid this tax, or there's this outstanding liability, and if you don't take care of this immediately, there are going to be severe repercussions. So it's sort of, you know, do this or you're going to be in big trouble. So it's kind of that fear factor. So there's a lot of different types. There's a number of like five or seven different influence techniques, and to get someone to undertake that, and those are used for manipulating the individual to undertake an action.
Thank you. And I love how you said it that way. Manipulate them to take an action that they otherwise probably wouldn't have, or maybe to act faster than they would have. I was trying not to leak this out in how I asked the question. So now I'll bring it full circle. Often when I'm asked about the word manipulation, I feel like people have a naturally negative relationship with the word. It's bad to manipulate. My personal feeling is that we manipulate people all day long, and it can be either good or bad. But the end result or the techniques that we're using, like those can help differentiate whether it is, for lack of better phrases, positive manipulation or negative manipulation. So I think about my son. I have a young son. I want him to clean his room faster. I'm probably going to have to manipulate him. I want him to try a new vegetable. I'm absolutely going to have to manipulate him. Now, that doesn't make me unethical or a bad dad. It can go either way. So I love the way that you said it. I do just want to obviously offer the opportunity for you to correct me. Do you feel like there can be positive and negative manipulation, or am I looking at that the wrong way?
No, you are absolutely right. I mean, children will manipulate us. We will manipulate children. Sometimes school teachers have to manipulate children within the classroom to get them necessarily to, you know, if you do this, you're going to get a star, right? I mean, that's manipulation, right? You're going to get that silver star, that golden star. Nothing wrong with that. I mean, many times some people need incentives, right? And as a parent or as a manager, if you know to get your children or your employees to be, you know, manipulated to undertake, you know, something that's going to be a benefit for the team, the end goal is something that's going to be positive, right? So there's different things that we do to manipulate. You know, practically any person that's decent in sales, is good in sales, is going to be using, you know, manipulation skills. I mean, once again, it doesn't mean that they're bad. I mean, this is something that to be a good person, good salesperson, you're going to have to manipulate. You're going to have to size up your client, your prospective buyer, right? And what are some of their goals? What are some of the things that they like? What are some of their concerns? And try to address these things to, at the end of the day, to get them to say, instead of no, 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 get them to say yes, yes, yes. So you're right. Manipulation, typically, if you use that word, it has negative connotations, but maybe incentivize would be another way to use that term without it, you know, burying those. You know, but in my career, my work, I focus on manipulation because I focus on how it is used by threat actors to do things, to do bad things, you know, yeah, to us. So that's why I would say proudly use the word manipulation, but I wanted to make very, very clear to people that, you know, this is something that could be have negative repercussions for you if you allow it to happen.
Certainly. And I appreciate you indulging me on that, kind of the intricacies of the word or how people feel about it. But let's get back to what you learned from the threat actors. I would imagine that in today's world, how we communicate through technology, often more than we do face-to-face, that it is easier for more threat actors to approach people through technology than it is face-to-face. I would imagine it takes another level of threat actor to approach somebody face-to-face than it does to approach them through technology. So if that assumption is incorrect, please correct me. Assuming it's correct-ish, what are some of the alert signals that people should be looking for, whether it is through social media, text, email, online, that let them know that this might be a threat actor communicating with them, not somebody who has positive intentions?
Okay, well, let me go back to your first part of your comment, because I think it's important to expand upon why because of technology, there's so much more opportunities for threat actors to reach out and contact people. I mean, think about, you know, I come from the day pre-internet, you know, and so if you look at how many people did we really know, how many people knew us, maybe you had a couple dozen at the most, right? But now with the internet, we can collect a lot of targeting data on people that we've never met, okay? I'm talking about how many, you know, think about this, 4.6 billion people on social media. 4.6 billion. On LinkedIn, it's a billion people on that platform, profiles. And about 15% of that, those are fake profiles. So there's a lot of people that are out there impersonating, you know, whoever they want to impersonate and collecting data on individuals. And that data then is used for more targeting, right? And so then once I collect that data, I mean, so we got a lot of resources that are out there today because of technology and social media to collect the data on people that we might be interested in targeting. And that kind of like sizing them up. What are some things, you know, motivates them or vulnerabilities? And then with that information, I'm going to develop my approach, right? How what's my pretext for contacting them? And, you know, how I need to sort of like map out where might this go? I don't have this pretext for calling them or contacting them, email or text or even phone call. Who am I? What do I want? You know, why have I contacted them, and what do I want them to do? Whether it's something offering them this great opportunity or saying, you know, you're in serious problems right now and I can help fix this result right now for you if you do what I say, right? So it's sort of like this means of the targeting pool is tremendous now. And the threat actor does not have to expose themselves, right? They don't have to go out there and expose their image their name when they contact somebody. So they can, in essence, the same person, the same threat actor could approach the same target from multiple directions, just change their name, right? Because, you know, I understand this from the real world when we're dealing in intelligence, not every single approach that we have is successful. Something might just, you know, get off to a bad start. We might say something that's wrong, or maybe our cover for a pretext is in the work, and then we're kind of done because we can't really go back at that person again. We can maybe find a colleague who works for us as a social engineer and say, hey, this is what I collected on this person. Now you try it with another pretext to approach them, right? But, you know, we ourselves are burned, say, in essence. But now with the technology today, There's so many ways that we can approach the same target from multiple directions and multiple identities. So it's just amazing. It's just amazing how much this technology has facilitated the collection of data and the types of ploys that can be used and communications that can be used in approaching our intended victim, right?
I can only imagine, and even just from the small slice that I'm aware of, and whether it's the email phishing, people using email addresses that are similar to but not exact, or the text messages, the social media, it's so easy to fake a social media account and act like you're somebody. And to your point, a lot of what we put out there, people can use against us. It frustrates people who I know where I'm like, well, why would you put a sticker of your alma mater on your car? Well, I'm proud of where I graduated from. Well, you should be. But now everybody that you see in the parking lot, in the store, in the mall, the restaurant or whatever, they've got a reason to start a conversation with you. And now that they've got a reason to start a conversation with you, it can be harder for us to disentwine them fast enough to protect ourselves depending on the situation that we're in. And I feel like my friends think I'm crazy when I bring that stuff up. And maybe I am. But to your point, I feel like everything we put out gives people a reason or an opportunity to approach us. And if we're not at least aware of that, then we could be creating issues for ourselves.
You hit upon the key concept here, aware. Because I used to, and I've been in this business for quite a while and in educating people as well. And one of my first things is limit the amount of information you're putting out there, because that information can be exploited, right? And I talked on this, I'm blue in the face, and people can be careful. People can be careful. But these days, I don't know if you kept tabs, but how many of those letters have you received from organizations that said your information has been compromised?
Oh.
There's been a data breach. I'm aware of it, in my case, at least 5 to 6, and some of them big. I mean, I can come back to this a little bit later if you want to talk about how my information has been exploited by a foreign government. But that sort of thing, you know, that's out there now, right? It's in probably the dark web. Anybody that has access to the dark web pays a small fee, can buy this information, you know, your personal identifier information at a very minimum, right? Which is pretty significant. Your social security numbers, your address, your date of birth, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So we've pretty much lost control of our personal information. We can still try to exercise, you know, best practices, and I highly recommend that. But in essence, we lost a lot of control over our information. So I think the important shift is our mindset now about, you know, having that public awareness and understanding how that information, you know, whether we had control over it, we lost it, or we didn't have control, how that information now can be used against us, how it can be used to target us. So that's what it comes down to. And you have what I call healthy paranoia. And that is what everybody should have. A little bit of skepticism, right? Healthy paranoia, you should know, when do I have to exercise this healthy paranoia versus being paranoid all the time, right? It's kind of like this, do I trust or do I have tempered trust? Do I trust in everything or do I trust in nothing, which is probably not where we want to go? Or do we trust, we know exactly, when do I have to exercise greater trust in something that is happening right now? How can I trust something that's real, right? And that's where we really need to have more of that focus on our awareness and understanding when it's coming, what are those red flags? I think I maybe didn't address an earlier question about red flags. What are those red flags that can come in that should have me pause a bit and say, listen, I need to verify what is being asked of me or what I'm being, you know, sort of influenced, manipulated into doing before I undertake and actually execute that. But there's a lot of things that come in, and maybe it's just informative. Does that mean that we have to be paranoid and not, you know, trust it? No, not necessarily. But if something's coming into us, you know, say wanting us to click on that link in that email, even if it looks like it's coming from your trusted service provider, you don't click on that link in the email under no circumstances, no circumstances. Or you get that text, you know, with a link to click on. You know, or in a social media, like a DM in a social media, you can get, you know, almost all these social media accounts now have this direct messaging feature, which can also carry a link or an attachment. You have to be absolutely sure that it is coming from a trusted source. You know, and how can you do that? How can you do that? In the case of almost all of the service providers you're dealing with, you can just get onto their website and verify that whatever notification they're sending to you, it's going to be on that website as well. And then, you know, I can trust it, you know, and I will undertake that action when I'm already logged in to a secure website and not doing it just so something that's coming through my Yahoo or my Gmail account or whatever. So it's coming down to really, you know, making a decision. And it's not, you know, what really, I wrote something about this today on LinkedIn. I keep on hearing over and over and over again, trust, but verify. I say, no, this is like a mindset that goes back 20 years. You don't trust and then verify. If you trust something and then, you know, take some action and then let me just check to make sure that this is legitimate, it's too late. The damage is done. It's almost irreversible, you being able to correct this issue now. You have to first verify before you trust. And it just gets to me. I don't know, these people, they don't really think about, you know, words make a difference. The order of those words make a huge difference. And people just throw out that slogan thinking that, oh yeah, we're being smart. We're going to be, no, but you have to do things in the proper order. You have to understand really what you're doing and why you're doing it.
Yeah, we tend to live in a world, I feel like, where people love an easy to remember quote by a famous person that they can continue to regurgitate over and over and over and over and over again without having to put independent thought into it.
A lot of people say that Ronald Reagan was the, it actually goes back to the Russians. Yeah. Not that there was any connection there, but I'm saying Russians used that expression a long time ago.
Yeah.
Verify.
I can't pretend to know the story, but I think he's famous for using it in speaking to the Russians, and he used it specifically because it was a Russian phrase.
I think you're right. Yeah.
Fact check me on that one. I could be wrong again. You've mentioned a lot of good points, and we're going to have to come back and pay off that tease about a foreign government using your personal information. We won't do it just yet, but I would love to get back to the red flags. You just mentioned a couple. If it's a link, if it's a direct message, somebody you don't recognize, I guess we could look at it two ways. One way would be electronically. Another way would even be in person. Hopefully people who are listening to the show aren't being approached by assets from other countries, but we could still be approached by people who want our wallet, our phone. They're trying to distract us to do something else. Maybe if we're single, we're young, we're out places, people might be looking to take advantage of us. So there's still other ways that we want to be alert to these red flags. So I guess if we could divide it into two categories to the degree that you want to address them, for both technology and in-person communication, what are some of the top line red flags that we should be looking out for?
Well, first of all, I would say in regards, if I'm a human hacker, I would prefer always to get somebody on the telephone or in person because I have more control of where this may be going. I can easily measure the what is being said by the other person, kind of like how they respond. Are they kind of like going along with what I'm saying, or do I sense hesitation, or are they bringing up a potential objection? You know, if they're bringing up a potential objection to that email coming in, I might never know. Maybe they won't respond. But if I get them on a line, on a telephone line, it's so much more effective to be able to ultimately get them to do whatever you want them to do as a human hacker, and especially in person. I mean, I'm not meaning to break, but I was in the business of recruiting sources during my 23-year career with the Central Intelligence Agency. And not once did I not succeed in recruiting somebody who I pitched because I was able to bring them along. You know, I was able to really kind of like take their pulse, you know, all the way along to make sure, you know, are they still along with me, or is there something I need to address? Because I sense that they're not comfortable. I mean, at the end of the day, when I make that pitch, I knew that with almost certainty that they were going to accept it, right? Because you have that sort of engagement. Now, if you're dealing with, with your question about emails or text messages, they kind of come out of the blue. It could be something that totally comes out of the blue. And almost always they're going to be asking you to take some action due to what they put in that email, right? Most of the time it's going to be clicking on that link And you click on that link, it might take you to what you think is their website, even. It might be a cloned site of that service provider. So you think, oh, it's taking me there. This has got to be legitimate, but not necessarily. It could be cloned. Or they might take you to a place where they want you to fill in information. What's the purpose of this actually ploy? Could be to just collect information on you, or it could be something more nefarious, trying to get you to actually, to make a payment for something that's totally fraudulent. So it's going to trying to be in it to entice you, and it's going to be once again there's a number of different influence techniques. Well, and probably the biggest one that works today is that fear factor, not just with the elderly, with anybody really, afraid that something is going to happen. There's been a huge increase of cyber sexual extortion, where people will engage, typically young men, maybe between the ages of 16 and 22, and they're working out, a lot of them are working out of East Africa. And they will engage somebody and impersonate being a female, and be engaging that person, and get to the point where they get that target to share with them a sexually explicit photo, right? And then turn it around all of a sudden, saying, "Oh, this is the father of the girl," or whatever. All of a sudden now they're in big trouble. This happened to my nephew not too long ago, and you can imagine when all of a sudden this is turned around on you. And they were so even clever. These guys they impersonated law enforcement from the city. He lives out in the country, but from the nearest town. They impersonated law enforcement that were coming, and they were going to undertake some action against this individual. He, Matt Gutray, he was terrified. He was terrified, and he had to make payment, right? So he was like trying to get some money, and his mom noticed something was not quite right, right? She said, "What's going on?" And fortunately, he confided to her. And right away, she said, "Don't do that. This is a scam. Cease from this. And do not even respond to any of these anymore." She fortunately was able to save him from making a very, very serious mistake. Now, there's even more unfortunate circumstances where kids will not confide to their parents. And maybe they'll start making payments. And then they'll get themselves so, over their head, to the point of they commit suicide. And there's been a number of suicides, particularly of young men who have been pulled into this thing, right? So it's sort of like extortion, right? They're trying to they get a hook into you while they're baiting you with this attractive young lady. And then they turn it around where they're extorting you, that if you don't do this, something really bad's going to happen to you, using fear, right? They can impersonate any form of law enforcement, Social Security or IRS or FBI. But these institutions will always say, "We never will call you by telephone." But yet people fall for these telephone calls. Probably because even though in the back of their mind, they've heard this, when all of a sudden they're faced with, this terrible situation, fear is amazing, amazing, amazing how much that can have an impact on someone, and feeling that they don't respond to this right away, the problem is going to get so much more drastic, right? So with almost all of those type of ploys, it's getting you to buy gift cards or make some kind of wire transfer or to get out of this problem. And many times what's even happens is that we don't hear a lot about these things. We might see that if you go to the FTC, you might hear statistics, right? But statistic is a statistic. When we start hearing these things from our family and friends that they were victimized, that one becomes to resonate a little bit closer to home. And I think we have to encourage more testimonials from people that have been targeted and been victimized, because they can in fact help people from maybe falling victim. Another really big one, and it's just to me it's amazing, but these romance scams, they happen to people of all ages, but typically, once again, it's usually the seniors or the elderly that are more successfully targeted for two reasons. First of all, it's a very, very interested target group, because a senior, someone who's in there, that's 60 years old compared to someone that's 20, probably has a lot more wealth, right? If you go after someone that's 20, what are you going to get from them, right? Maybe you get, maybe $1,000 maybe, if you're lucky. But with a senior, there are cases that they have lost their entire life savings. And it's so sad. I've heard about this. And if your audience likes to, here are some of these really fortunate situations. They can Google it, and you can see videos of people. There's even one that's called social catfishing. And there are times when there's some seniors that have, you know, fortunately contacted them to try to run down, is this legitimate or not? But what happens with a lot of these people, once they fall for these romance scams, you can't convince them. You can't convince them that it's a fraud. They really believe that this person is in love with them and they're in love with this person. They will not accept any sort of rationale, any sort of rationale. And we see these people sending hundreds of thousands, you know, in some cases over $1 million to these people. So you know what? So kind of like, what can we do? And I even wrote about this earlier this morning as well. We can't necessarily save somebody that's already gone down that hole. Unfortunately, what we really have to do is be much more proactive in doing, you know, using your meetings such as your podcast to talk about these things, and for us to talk to our parents, get involved in our parents' lives. What are they doing? Who are they in contact with on social media? They should not have a problem with telling you, oh, you know, I'm in contact with this person or that person. This is what we talk about. You know, it all seems very innocent, right? Why would they not talk to you about it? You know, but try to find out what they're doing and then, you know, educate them on these scams so that when something comes in for the first time, they may think, oh, yeah, my son or my daughter told me about this. Huh. Maybe before I go too far, I need to verify something here, right? But you got to do it up front. You got to do it up front. We need much more awareness of these types of red flags that can surface. So you go the whole gamut where you might have an email that they're just getting you to try to click on a link, you know, or to upload malware to your computer, or for you to maybe, you know, for them to get more information from you, or for them to maybe make a wire transfer, get a hold of your banking information, or they're trying to get in direct contact with you and manipulate you through a relationship, right? Whether it's by phone or, you know, for in person. And what's kind of interesting is a lot of these romance scams, it's so frequent. They will get somebody using one of these telephone apps and they'll only send text messages or speak on the telephone, but they won't video chat. They will avoid video chat. And that's such a big red flag right there. Today, almost everybody video chats. People like to video chat. They feel more of a connection with that person, especially if they're looking at potential love interest. Why wouldn't you want a video chat? You know, why does everything have to come through text messages or come through, you know, email or, you know, maybe an occasional phone call? Because you're not seeing who's on the other end of that call, right? So it's kind of a complex scenario. Let me go, you know, with AI, this is becoming even more complex, more as far as the threats, okay? What can happen? How effective threat actors now can target you, first of all, using AI. I'm sure that most of your listeners are familiar with ChatGPT, right? Now, ChatGPT does amazing things. I use it periodically. And what a lot of people don't necessarily, you know, realize, ChatGPT has the technology to pretty much scrape the entire internet and pull up all kinds of data that's out there about you. It has that capability, but if for ethical reasons, it will not do it. It will scrape together information regarding, you know, people that are celebrities, politicians, like as if you were doing a normal Google search, right? Pulling all this information together. But for them to pull information from you, about me or you, not really, because it has those guardrails in place, fortunately. If you take away those guardrails, that technology is there. And that technology is exploited. There's even a site on the dark web called FraudGPT, which does this, okay? For a fee of, I think it's a couple $100 a month, or maybe a 1-year subscription of $1,700, you can have access to this tool that does. It is no ethics, right? No ethics are involved. You don't have to worry about, you know, anything being illegal, because everything's open, right? If you can exploit these tools that are available now that weren't available before, so being able to collect the information on the targets and then being able to use deepfake, you know, AI in deepfake technology. To what does it do? I mean, think about it. What it does is increase the trust factor in that outgoing communication, right? What, you know, if it's let's say they're sending a picture or a video, they can be fabricating that video to make it look like any person, you know, is saying or doing something that they've never been involved in doing, right? Or an image, a picture, they can manipulate that picture. So you trust what you're trusting, what you're seeing in that picture, because you know the seeing is believing, right? That but we got to get away from that. All these things can be manipulated. And one of the biggest ones right now that really, you know, over this last year has been these virtual kidnappings, commonly referred to as grandparent scams. Because why? Because I guess these, a lot of these scams have been targeted toward, you know, the parents or children, or parents or grandparents of the person that they're trying to impersonate has been gotten into a serious accident or has been arrested by the police or, you know, been kidnapped. And so I've seen this type of kidnapping, virtual kidnapping is going on for years in Latin America and other third world countries. They've been going on for years, but they've been now introduced into the United States with this technology so that if someone is calling, not only do they just say, oh, we have your daughter, or we have your son, they're able to clone the voice of the daughter or the son or the grand, you know, child. They're able to clone it so that they can put that person online, right? Just for a few seconds. And man, that's their voice. And why would I not believe that that's them? That's their voice. And they're kidnapped. And I got to pay this money right away. Otherwise, something really bad is going to happen to them. So they're, you know, it's increasing the trust factor in the message, right? And it's employing fear and scarcity maybe of time, because I got to make this payment. I got to buy Bitcoin and send it within 2 or 3 hours or, you know, so fear, scarcity, and boosting up the trust factor in a communication. So this is ramp. This is running. This is becoming very, very serious. I mean, we've seen it also, you know, happening in financial institutions where bank personnel are fooled into believing that it's their boss that's calling them. You know, you might, you know, easily impersonate the phone number. I mean, I don't know if you've heard of spoof calling, but this is for a long time already. Human hackers just spoof the telephone number to make it look like it's coming from someone you know. You know, you're seeing the phone number. Oh, that's coming from the school where my kids go, or that's coming from this person or that person. So when you pick up the phone, you automatically assume that it's that person. And now with also cloning the voice, you're absolutely sure it's coming from this person, right? So the advice that I give to people, well, with all these things, you know, it looks complex, but the solution is so simple. It's the verification. And what people need to do, what they need to do, especially during this upcoming holiday season, this is very timely, you know, during the holiday season, especially, but any time of the year you have family gatherings, sit down with your family, discuss some of these things that have been happening, and establish a code word or code phrase so that if someone is calling and they say that they have, you know, Joey kidnapped, if there's not a, you know, if there's not a code word or phrase, when Joey gets on that phone, and he's not using this code word or code phrase, it's totally false, totally fabricated. Confirming that code, you know, that phrase or that code is what validates that this is a true emergency. Very simple to use, right? Very, very simple. That can save us, you know, thousands and thousands of dollars. And also, you know, people actually feel like it's a serious violation when they're taken like that. It's not just losing that money. I mean, they feel really bad, and they, you know, these are some emotional scars that people feel when they're taken advantage of. Severe emotion.
There is. And I feel like that's a lot of times is what stops people from either believing that they've been hacked or this has been a fraudulent relationship. It stops them from telling others, from seeking help, from all these things. And it helps protect the bad actor along the way. And when you talk about even just the code word, it's such a great point. It is really an easy thing to do and to put in place, little time, no money, all of these things. And it ties back into a conversation that we had recently on this podcast where we talked about preparing for the worst thing that could happen. People don't want to think about it. They don't want to direct any attention to it. Maybe they're worried about speaking it into existence or any one of these things. But by preparing for it in advance, we're ready to handle it when it happens, because as you brought up, fear causes our brain to shut down. Yeah. And once our brain shuts down, now we're susceptible to all of these things that you've talked about. I'd love to try to flip this positive for a few minutes. You talked about being successful with your pitches, recruiting sources, and that you were really bringing them along over a period of time. So I'm assuming that there are ethical and positive applications to those techniques that we can use as leaders to help create buy-in and morale and teamwork in our businesses. You brought up sales professionals before. I imagine there's positive applications that we can use building relationships in sales with our families as well. So I'm very curious. I don't know if the right word is tradecraft or techniques or influence, but the things that you learned in the field to develop these sources, what are some of the techniques that we can apply in our lives ethically to build stronger relationships that are, and I hate this phrase, but I'm going to use it, that are, no, I'll do this instead, that are positively beneficial for all parties involved?
Okay, yeah, good question. There's a number of things. What can make, I think this maybe focus more on people that are involved in managing people. A lot of people are involved in some way of managing people or participating in teams and managing people.
Yeah.
And it's unfortunately, I mean, I think we've all had experiences of working for bad managers. You know, so what's a bad manager? It's basically, you know, they might be there because of, they've been with the company a certain amount of time. I mean, yeah, it doesn't mean that they're good managers at all. A good manager is someone that's also a leader. It's someone that the communication is two ways. It's not the same, you need to implement X, Y, Z. It's really being able to sit down with an individual and have a dialogue with them, right? And finding out what is, you know, what's working well for them, what's not working well, what are some of their aspirations? Because individuals are not with their employer just because they want to pay. I mean, normally they shouldn't be just because they want a paycheck. It should be much more than that. It should be that they feel that they're growing, you know, that they're growing, they'll be allowed to grow, they're given opportunities to grow, and a good manager is going to allow that person, also foment that person, even if it means losing that person from the team, because they should really care for that individual. They want what's best for that individual as well. They need to practice empathy. And unfortunately, not enough people do that. In my career, you know, empathy was very important. And I think empathy across the board, whether you're doing it for, you know, malicious or really positive means, empathy is one of the keys. If you don't empathize with the person that you're trying to, you know, have a relationship with and incentivize, perhaps, you're missing the boat. And we have to be able to, you know, if we're going to roll out something, we're thinking about rolling out something, we should get input. And I wouldn't say just in one of these surveys that gets sent out to people, but being able to sit down, especially if we have a smaller team, maybe sit down with each one of them individually and saying, this is something, these are some of the things we're thinking about. You know, how does that, you know, what would be, you know, what do you think about this? Would this be something that could be positive or negative? And then you get that kind of input, that's, you know, that feedback that you can take back and then, you know, revamp or tailor or you know, get that sort of confirmation. Yeah, we want to go forward with these changes or, you know, forward because we know that people are going to support it. We've already kind of like, you know, had that discussion with them and they feel that they've had a buy-in, right? Which is so important. So I think it comes down to some of the basics in communication, right? Communication has to be two ways. Not just one-way communication is not necessarily effective, right? If we're just giving orders, how do we know that that's effective communication? We don't. Until later, things are not complied with. What happened? You know, why did it break down? Because it wasn't properly communicated, you know? So I think that's probably one of the biggest areas for me is to really, really have that two-way communication and empathize with the person you're trying to develop that relationship with as part of your team, if you're a manager, right?
Yeah. No, great point. And universal points, whether it's business, whether it's family, it applies all the way through. I'm curious to the degree that you can share. I'm sure that there were relationships you were developing in the field where you could sense the hesitancy. You could sense the lack of trust. You could sense the skepticism in the people that you were attempting to recruit. Many of us in business, whether it's within our own organizations or developing sales relationships, run into similar feelings, much different contexts, but similar feelings and obstacles, if you will. What were some of your most successful approaches for helping people work through those needs so they would connect with you and establish the relationship you were looking for?
The first one was really being able to anticipate. You know, we have these elevator speeches, right? And in the elevator speech, we should already sort of have thought about what could be some of the reaction, you know, some of the, you know, rejection or things that could concern somebody when we get that elevator speech. We should try to front load that person doesn't have that particular question or concern because whatever we have addressed, it's already hit that, you know, I can't remember the term, but sort of like, you know, you hit that before it even becomes an issue. Become an issue. Yeah. But once you can, I mean, it's so important when you're dealing with somebody, especially in person, that you're able to read their body language, right? Someone could be nodding their head, you know, I mean, someone could be like they don't say anything. Maybe that sounds like they're hesitating, but there's other things that they might show some sort of discomfort.
Yes.
Or, you know, they're skeptical about something, but they're not telling you, I don't believe this, or, you know, they're not expressing verbally that. So you got to read that community. You got to read those nonverbal communication factors, and then you need to address them. You know that they're feeling uneasy. They're feeling unskeptical. Find some way to bring up, you know, you seem like, you know, this is concerning you, or how do you feel about that? Tell me how you feel, you know, and get the person to express that. Because I've seen cases where individuals have taken something full, you know, full blown, and that person is just not buying into it, but they're kind of like going, and what can really be bad, they're going along with it, and maybe they even notify local law enforcement, local police in that country, hey, I got this person that just seems so suspicious. And then law enforcement says, you know, keep us informed, keep going on that path, see where it goes. And you, I mean, that's like the worst thing you can do in my field, is just going along with something where the whole thing blows up on you. It's compromised and you might end up in prison. You know, so you really gotta know, you gotta be able to measure how that individual, you know, is progressing along this trajectory of trust in what you're saying and doing, presenting to them.
That's a great point. And I feel like a far less serious correlation is often in sales, where we're so hell-bent on going through our pitch, asking the questions we always answer, going through the slide deck we always go through, whatever it is, that the person in front of us might literally be nodding along or saying yes because they want to get the hell out of the conversation as fast as possible. Or they might ask for the proposal really quick, because, or even worse, we ask them, would you like a proposal? And they say, yes, I would. And we feel like, great, we're winning. No, we're not. That was the quickest eject button they had. And because, to your point, we weren't looking for those incongruencies, we weren't slowing down, we weren't taking our time, we were ignoring our observations, we missed all of those red flags going through. So you just mentioned the, you know, worst case scenario, someone maybe goes to local law enforcement, you could end up in jail, you know, knock on wood, clearly we don't want that happening. But that might be a good time to circle back to the tease from earlier, where you talked about foreign governments, or a foreign government potentially having access to your information and using it. Are there parts of that story that you can share with us that might be educational for us?
Oh, absolutely. Because this has already been out in the press.
Okay.
Talked about briefly, but then like so many things kind of like forgotten. And it's something that's, I think we need to be considering about the future, and it can be very, very severe. There were a series of at least four entities that had their IT, you know, had their databases breached from a time frame about 2013 to 2017. One of them was Anthem, so a major healthcare provider. Think about all the information healthcare providers have, right? A lot of information. You can already imagine what kind of information they have. Then go on to the breach of OPM, Office of Personnel Management. For those of your listeners that might not know what that is, it's the repository of all the information that's been collected on an individual who's being considered for security clearance. So everything, we're talking much bigger than just your PII information. We're talking about everything, including your health information, your credit information, you know, if you've had an affair with your spouse, affair on your spouse, you know, things that your spouse might not even, you know, not even be aware, but you kind of like these things come out during these investigations. And basically, that information was stolen by a state actor, and it held about 22 million individuals who have recently security clearances. So 22 million U.S. citizens with security clearances, which both myself and my wife had our information breached of that. And what we got was a letter from the OPM saying, you know, so sorry this happened, but this information, you know, from the databases was taken to even include your fingerprints. We'll provide for you, like a lot of these companies will provide 1 year of credit monitoring, as if that, you know, is a state actor, probably don't have to worry about, you know, criminal group using this information to, you know, to impersonate you. And then there was one more, the Marriott International. And with Marriott International, it also includes a lot of travel information to include your passport and passport information, et cetera. So these are four of known data breaches conducted by the Chinese government. All of them conducted by the Chinese government. And none of them had that information posted on the dark web where criminals would be, you know, buying and selling this information. It was all done by the state actor, Chinese government. And for the purpose, we can only speculate. So I want to leave this is what happened. And it's been confirmed by the US government. Now, not many people speculate this. I don't know why, but there should be a lot of speculation and there should be some action taken that as an intelligence operations, if I want to try to recruit somebody in the US who has information of very sensitive value, I mean, sensitive information, right? Of intelligence value sometimes, and or someone who could be an agent of influence, I'm going to be collecting this information so that I can learn about what makes this person tick, you know, the motivations, vulnerabilities. It might be a very friendly approach, or it could be something that could be, you know, even extortion, right? But the means being trying to, you know, improve their ability to spot, assess, develop, and have successful recruitment pitches against U.S. citizens with have access to the highest authorities in the U.S. government. So this is what we really need to be concerned about. And I see this, you know, undoubtedly this is going to happen. And I think the U.S. government needs to take more action in developing programs. I mean, maybe they are. I mean, maybe I'm out of the loop, but if we as citizens are not aware that there's such a program, I kind of have my doubts that it's being one that's very planned out or effective within the, you know, upper echelons of our government, of people that could be targeted by, you know, targeted by state actors such as China. So yeah, so that I was, you know, I felt that one, you know, and big time. And I even have that letter somewhere stored away here, you know, free credit monitoring. Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, free credit monitoring is probably not what foreign governments are going, or if they're going to come for you, it's not the credit most likely where they will. And it is scary to stop and think about where our information could be and who has it. And for somebody who was in your role, what information could they have and why might they be interested in somebody like you based on your previous history and who you've been associated with and all those things that we don't have to get into. Before I circled back to that, there was another question I wanted to ask related to developing sources and encouraging people to share information. I imagine that somewhere along that process, it probably happened throughout, but imagine there were bigger payoffs at the end of some of those processes where you were looking to elicit information from people. Again, to the degree that you can share, we're not going for anything, even in the gray area. What are some of the more successful elicitation techniques that you used in the field that you feel like would also directly translate to business development, negotiation, leadership conversations as well?
I think that almost all of the elicitation techniques that I use in the field have direct implication, you know, into the private sector or you know, in the civilian world, for everybody to use. They really do, because the art of elicitation it's an art form. And it's so important, and there's just so much that we can learn. And you know, elicitation basically is collecting that information from a human being, right? And usually it's face to face. Doesn't have to be. It could be over the telephone. It could be actually even in forums when you're online and you're dealing with somebody on a forum and you know, asking them questions. Or so it can take place. Email. It can be done, you know, exchanging of text messages or email. It can be done via most types of communication channels, but probably the most effective, once again, is going to be that face-to-face interaction, right? Because you're also able to look at the body language of somebody and see if they're comfortable with it. And what you want to do is you want to lead them along, and it could be a one-time elicitation, or if you have the opportunity, you can plan this elicitation over multiple meetings, right? You want to plan in advance. What are some specific things I want to learn about this individual? And or about this individual's, you know, role in an organization, or even specific information about an organization. You plan those in advance, and you plan in advance what technique you're going to use to actually get there. You know, so you kind of like whiteboard this. Think about it, whiteboarding, and also okay, this is the information I want. this is how I'm going to interject a comment or a question and have it brought up. You know, and I might, in preparation of a meeting, maybe I have 7 different things that I'm going to try to hit. Maybe I only successfully hit 3 or 4 of them, but I'm going to collect all this information about somebody without them even realizing. You know, it's not like an interview. You know, people, when they go to an interview, they realize an interview. You know, they're being asked questions. That person asking the questions in a position of authority, you know, maybe it's like somebody from HR. Maybe it's someone that's doing a security investigation. And you know who they are. They know why they're asking the question. And you know how far you're going to go and what information you provide to them. For the most part, you're pretty sincere. But maybe there's some information you don't want to provide to them because, say, well, if I tell this HR person here, I might put me in a bad light. So I'm going to try to hide that information, right? With elicitation, the target, the individual that you're eliciting the information from, does not know the pretext. They see this as a very casual conversation, right? And very friendly, casual. And at the end of that session, they don't realize the amount of information that they pulled up. Some very basic ones, I mean, we can go through some of them, but most basic ones, think about a good elicitor is one that can get to a point and then shut up. Let the person talk. I kind of found like all my relationships, whether they were, you know, like even days, early days of dating or, you know, in the field when I was actually trying to elicit information from targets, the more I could just shut up, the more people would talk. They would talk and it would feel like already this relationship with you. Oh, finally someone that listens to me. It sounds kind of crazy, but it is true. It's amazing how much more people will trust you and talk to you if they feel that you are giving them the opportunity, that you're listening to them, right? So one of the first things is called open versus closed questions, right? If I asked a closed question, it could be like, did you enjoy your trip to China? And, you know, it could be a yes or a no. Or what were the things that you most enjoyed about going to China? And that's going to, you know, elicit from them more examples, more things that, you know, a lot more information, right? Another thing would be, we can use flattery, right? Compliment people, but not overly doing it. You might want to refer to something that you know that, you know, work that they've done and compliment them and how successful they've been in their career, or compliment them on some, what they call these pins that they might love on their lapel. Well, that's a very pretty pin, you know, or an interesting pin. What's that all about? So flattery, as long as it's not overdone, flattery can be very, very effective. And we can also use in a conversation, I'm just trying to think, I'm going blank here for a second. And remembering bringing up something that's been in the news, okay, so referring to some incident that happened and getting them to comment about it. And right away, you know, especially if it's like something that might be political, you can probably much right away, just based on their response to an event, you can kind of get a good insight into what are their politics, right? You know, even if they don't go deep into it, you can probably figure out right away if they're more, you know, Democrat or Republican, or if they're, you know, more left or more right or center, you know, you can get those kind of feelings about how they feel about something. You can criticize something. It's very effective. Something that they're maybe intimately involved in or know about, and you criticize it and you want to see, are they agreeing with your criticism or are they trying to defend a particular position, right? My friend John, you can easily create these scenarios. My friend John, or my brother-in-law who works for XYZ company, told me that, you know, they seem to have very intrusive policies when it comes to their contact with foreign nationals or their foreign travel. You know, when they've gone trips, they got to get pre-approval for the trip. When they come back, they have to mention every single person that they have contact with or have ongoing contact with. Is that normal in this industry? Does your company have those type of policies as well, right? I mean, so you get them to make comments about these things, but usually you're bringing up some story, you're making reference to something that you heard or said, I mean, you heard or read about, whether it's true or not, and you're getting them to respond to it. So these are a lot of different types of techniques that can be involved in getting somebody to talk.
Those are very good examples. And the point about shutting up couldn't be any more important. Like it's simple math. If there's enough space for one person to fill the conversation, I can't learn if I'm the one filling it. So I got to open up and let them fill it. So I love that. And really, I love the whole premise of encouraging people to share information without necessarily asking them a question. So you point, you offer up the criticism, you make a reference, you comment on the news. I'm not asking a question.
Right.
But the conveyed expectation is that was my turn, now it's your turn. And then we learn from their turn.
Absolutely. Because if you start asking direct questions, that's what's going to put somebody, especially in the early relationship, that's going to put them a little bit off guard. Like, you know, why, you know, that's when they're going to really be able to focus on, whoa, they're asking about this thing that's kind of sensitive, yeah. Right? So you really want to try to avoid asking direct questions. And when you start seeing that someone's a little bit uncomfortable, you know, either you need to provide a little bit more reason about why you're making that comment, or you need to know when to back off and just change it, you know? Change it and maybe come back at it a little bit later under some other type of pretext to try to get to the information that you're interested in. I ask a lot of people who kind of have a little bit of understanding about, you know, people that are in the intelligence world and trying to develop sources, you know, to become FI, you know, foreign intelligence sources. Who do they think is better? Somebody who is extrovert or who is introvert as a case officer?
I would guess an introvert, because they're more likely to let the other person take control. And when the other person is in control, their guard goes down.
Exactly. That's very true. But a lot of people will say extrovert. They're not thinking that through. But the extrovert, I mean, you think the extrovert having so much energy, being so conversive and being able to, you know, talk. And the introvert is kind of like, I'm tired. I want to get away from this, you know, which is true. I'm an introvert. But when I had a particular, you know, objective, you know, meet this person at this cocktail, it would be laser focused. It would be light with, you know, the switch would come on and I would do that, you know, for as long as I had, you know, as long as I could. And then when I was done, I was exhausted. And that's when I would just go back, write down my notes, and then have a glass of wine and go to sleep. You know, I didn't want to do it. I didn't like it, but I had to do it. And it was much more effective. And most of the people that I know who I worked with in the agency will also say, yeah, they tend to be more introverted. It's really
interesting. I believe so. I could see how an extrovert could turn somebody off, all that energy, all of that, like... If somebody is so interested in this conversation, maybe that's a red flag. Why are you so into this if we don't even really know each other? And I would imagine that the introvert can do a better job being who the other person needs them to be, as far as the extrovert, who is potentially more likely to be in your face. This is me. I mean, I'm oversimplifying it, but so I can certainly see the advantages of the introvert. And to that point, I feel like, and I know we're running up on time, and I really appreciate everything that you shared with us today. It clearly feels like we could keep this conversation going on for at least another hour, and there are more nuggets and more insights to mine from the conversation. I know you have a book. I know you have blogs. You have a website. You teach. So for the people who are enjoying this conversation and want to learn much more from you, how do they find you? Where do they go? How else and where else can they continue to learn from you?
Oh, thank you very much. Probably the easiest place to go if they have a LinkedIn account is look me up on LinkedIn, Peter Warmka. There's a lot of things on LinkedIn. That would be the first recommendation. You could also go to my website. You might want to jot this down because it's a little bit longer. Counterintelligence-institute.com. Okay. There you can find a lot of information, a lot of, you know, links to other social media accounts and YouTube, where I have videos that have been posted. So a lot of written material as well as videos. And then, as you mentioned, I have two books. The first one that came out is titled Confessions of a CIA Spy, The Art of Human Hacking, which goes into it goes into a lot more detail about human hacking. And it was written more for organizations as well as their employees, right? To have a good understanding about how, you know, who are the threat actors, their objectives, and how they, you know, what's their methodology that they use to get at the data, right? By manipulating turning employees into insider threats, basically. But after I wrote that one, I thought, you know, there is a huge segment of our population that's not really given much guidance. That's kind of like not focused on enough. That, you know, our elderly, call them seniors or our elderly, who are the most victimized segment, and they don't have really the resources. They're kind of like forgotten as far as. And I think we all have this, you know, we all have this responsibility to try to create that awareness for them, you know, especially for, you know, if for our family members, you know, our parents and our grandparents, we need to have those conversations with them. We need to look for resources. So I decided to write a book, and it's entitled, Why Are You Messing With Me? A Senior Survival Guide on Fraud, Privacy, and Security. Both of these books that I mentioned are available on Amazon. You'll find links, you know, maybe in the show notes, but
yes, sure.
They're also on my LinkedIn page. And if you go directly to Amazon and just put my name there, these books will pop up. Great time, holiday season.
You're not kidding. And I'll absolutely put them in the show notes for you. And maybe another time we can have a conversation just about protecting the elderly alone. I feel like that's it's a big one. It's a sad one. We could go on for probably more than an hour there, but for people to have those conversations, pay more attention. And I feel like personally, one of the ways for us to avoid potentially being a victim is to realize that we fit a target profile potentially. And if we realize we fit a target profile, we can be more aware that somebody might be targeting us. And I feel like for some people who are already of a certain age or generation, that might be harder for them to awaken themselves to. Is that proper English? I don't know. But the sooner we can realize, maybe not all the time, not from the time we get up to the time we go to bed, but in certain situations, every single one of us fits a target profile. So if we can realize that in a certain scenario, I'm more likely to potentially be targeted or taken advantage of, we can be more alert to the red flags and we can do a better job of protecting ourselves and our most vulnerable family members.
No, that's true. I mean, I can give you this. The solution to probably save yourself from over 95% of human hacking attempts is being able to use critical thinking, right? And when you get that incoming message, whether it's email, text message, you know, phone or DM on a social media or face-to-face, you know, understand what is there, if there's no ask, no worries. If there's an ask and they want you to do something, you know, think about if this is fraudulent, what kind of consequences there could be for the company or for myself. And if there could be severe consequences that you're not, you know, you don't want to accept taking that risk, then that's when you need to step back and verify before trusting. If you do that, you really don't have anything to worry about. But you gotta be able to use this sort of methodology to protect yourself.
100%. And I can't thank you enough for being here today. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I appreciate everything that you shared. I look forward to continuing the conversations. Please stay
Absolutely.
Safe. Take care of yourself. I look forward to seeing you again soon.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Peter, thank you so much for an awesome conversation. I truly appreciate you sharing your time, your expertise, your stories, and helping us all get a better idea for not only how we can keep our businesses safe, but more importantly, how we can keep ourselves and our families safe. You shared so many great concepts. I really like how you talked about verify before you trust. In today's world, with our internet access, and as you pointed out, all the information that is out there, people put out for us, it really creates the opportunity for us to verify people and scenarios we're going into before we choose to trust them. I also really like how you talked about addressing our observations. All too many times we see something, we feel something, we sense something, and we either rationalize it away or we ignore it and keep moving, where if we had addressed the observation, we could have stopped a problem before or avoided a problem before it started. Your idea about code words for families is really important. In fact, I took that to heart and recently, after our conversation, took a trip to New York City and made sure that my son, my young son, was aware of what our code word was before we left. So thank you very much for sharing that. And of course, we should always be aware of the information that we put out and how people could potentially use that against us. Peter, thank you so much. I look forward to continuing our conversations. Thank you to everybody that joined us today as well. We appreciate you being here week after week to listen and learn from these conversations. Hopefully you're taking notes. Hopefully you're updating how, in this case, you take care of your family, take care of yourself and your business after listening. Of course, we want to thank our sponsors before we go. Again, before you go, check out the show notes, hit the links. Please go visit humantel.com. That's where you can learn all you need to know about how to identify shifts in emotion through changing facial expressions and nonverbal communication. It's backed by research. I've done it myself. You can read it all on their website and enter the code INQUASIVE25 for 25% off of the online training that you choose. Please also, if you're a professional interviewer, head over to certifiedinterviewer.com. That's where you can learn more about the International Association of Interviewers, the benefits, the applications, what it takes to be a part of the association, what you can contribute to the association. It's also where you can learn more about the Certified Forensic Interviewer designation, how to qualify, prepare for, and then leverage your designation after you pass the exam. While you're online, please check out Inquasive.com. That's where you can learn more about the training programs our clients ask us to customize for their senior leaders, their HR teams, and their sales teams to teach them how to apply the strategic observation and persuasive communication techniques necessary to obtain the everyday confessions in all of their high-impact conversations. Before you go, please take an extra second, like the show, share the show, subscribe to the show. We appreciate all your time and support. Stay safe, take care of each other, and we'll see you next time. Thank you.